this is Lynette Hill with New City Radio. It is the 16th of August, and I'm here with Shona Lee, who is a traditional Jewish storyteller called a Drutzilla. Shona Lee, what's a Drutzilla?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that.
Oh, excellent.
Drutzilla is a Yiddish oral storyteller. It is peculiar to the female line, a female storyteller passed down from grandmother to granddaughter. And because at the time that it flourished, it wasn't allowed for women to read and write, it is an oral tradition. So it's held in the heart and the tongue and the body and the mind. Very little is written down. And there are stories that you learn, so many, many beautiful wonder tales and folk tales and myths and legends. And you also learn a technique for remembering all of those stories.
So you learned this technique from your grandmother. And what would you like to tell us about her?
Oh, lots. So my grandmother, or my Bubba, as I would call her, she had learnt it from her grandmother, who'd learnt it from her grandmother.
So it was passed from grandmother to granddaughter.
Indeed,
not from
yes.
mother to daughter.
No, grandmother to granddaughter. And I think there were two reasons because of that. One would have been a very practical reason. As a mother, you were dealing with the home, you were dealing with the children, you were dealing with the day-to-day minutiae of just keeping the whole show on the road. And so as a grandmother, you had a little bit more time to spend with the granddaughter that you were teaching. So that is one of the reasons, very practical reason. But on another level, I think you do have a slightly different relationship, possibly more tolerant with your grandmother than you do with your mother. I think, especially with daughters, there's usually a spark. So I don't think there was any great mystical reason, but I think there were very practical and emotive reasons why that was. And you would start learning at the age of four through very simple games, you know, the sort of clapping games and the sort of thing that you would think of as playground games.
So but like rhymes or...
Rhyming and hand games and riddling games and word games and the telling of stories and a lot of make-believe, you know, as a child.
Yeah.
We were talking this morning about how, you know, your boat would be... your bed. See, I'm there already in my head. The bed would be the boat and the table would be a fortress, or in my case, a grocery shop. A very pedestrian young child. But we would be playing those make-believe games, and all the time she would be teaching me stories and telling me stories and making them come alive for me.
At what point did you realize that you were learning something special, or that there was a point to the games and they weren't just games?
I suppose between the ages of about 8 to 12. I mean, it took that long, no.
Yeah.
but mainly when I was about 8, you suddenly realize there's something going on that is much deeper. And I was younger, much younger than that, when I realized that I was going through something that other children didn't go through. When I wanted to go out and play, and my bubble would be, well, you just have to learn this bit first, or you just have to do this bit first. And there was a sense of great sort of unfairness about that. But I'm really grateful now, you know.
You didn't rebel and push back and say, oh, I don't want to learn that story today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, if I tell you that the nickname for my grandmother was Blunt Joe...
Oh dear.
And if I tell you that she survived the war in Europe as a Jew, it gives you some indication of the tenacity of the woman, you know. So she would always find a way. She was a bit of a trickster as well. Always find a way of making the exercise so enticing that in the end you didn't really want to rebel. You were doing it more because one felt one ought to. Rather than you really felt like that.
Yeah. You tell a wonderful story of walking through the forest one day and seeing a house that related to a story in an unexpected way. Could you share that story with us now?
Yes, yes. Well, there's a thing with the tradition that you learn the stories by walking them. So it's inconceivable just to sit down with a book and learn it in your head. When you're learning a story in a traditional way, you must physicalize it, you must walk it and internalize it. So that was something I was doing from a very young age. And I remember one particular story that involved a woodcutter who lived in the forest. And the story went on from there. Various trials and tribulations, and we were learning this story. And in hindsight, she obviously set this up a few days before mm-hmm. with friends of hers, but obviously through the eyes of a child, it was a totally magical experience. We were walking through the woods and we came across a cottage. It was actually the local ranger's cottage, because the people that lived there worked for the council maintaining woodlands and things.
Okay.
But they were friends of hers. So we came across this cottage, much like one would in the story. And she said, look through the window. And I looked through the window, and almost like in the story, there was a man and a woman sitting by a fire talking. And in the centre of the cottage was a living tree, which to my child's eye and my imagination was truly epic and wonder tale like. And she said, do you want to know the rest of the story? Well, of course I did. So she said, knock on the door and ask for it. So I knocked on the door. The guy opened the door and I was like, hello, the rest of the story, please. And he, without missing a beat, said, oh, come in. And me and my bubba came in, we sat down, and he told us the rest of the story as if it was his story.
Well, do you mind saying what the story was?
It was the story of the wooden sword, the woodcutter that becomes a water carrier, that becomes, in the end, the advisor for the king. Because no matter what the king does to him, he always outwits the king through the dexterity of his thought. And so that was the story. It's called The Wooden Sword, and many people will know it. So that was a magical way of learning. And I mean, I don't know if you want me to carry on, but the...
Please feel free.
I went back years later to this magical cottage in the woods, only to find that it wasn't this beautiful Hansel and Gretel thatched wonderland that I had envisaged, or my childlike memory had invested it with. But it was actually a council-built house of brick.
Just an ordinary house.
An ordinary house. Oh, right, it was in the middle of the forest.
Yes.
And when I looked at this sort of mythic tree, it was actually a spiral staircase with a tree trunk as its central, or a telegraph pole, who knew?
Yeah.
But wooden. And obviously I was so into the story that my mind had kind of made it this. And over the years, as we do as creatives and storytellers, had embellished. So I remember being mildly disappointed. Maybe that's the thing, never go back.
Never go back, oh well. But speaking of mental dexterity, as a Drusilla, your stories are not written down. You hold them in your head or in your body. You have 12 cycles of stories that you tell, and it's around 4,000 stories that you have memorized.
Yeah.
And can you explain why it's all mental and why it hasn't been written down? There's some concern about that.
Yes. Well, I can try and explain. Primarily, you're looking at a tradition that is passed on through women that don't read and write for whatever reason. So first of all, it has to be oral. The system to memorize must be portable, because you're looking at communities that are persecuted or pogromed or run out of town. So having a massive library of books is not an option. So a lot of the techniques for remembering the story are a series of physical keys to unlock those images and rehydrate the stories. I think that's one of the key reasons for doing it. How you can remember so many? Well, if you think about it, we remember so much about our lives. We don't script it. We don't have a library book that tells us everything. We remember them. And so the stories are held very much as memories that you then retell. The concern, these aren't written down. There is a worry that should I be hit by a bus, not that I'm tempting the heavens at all, they would disappear. So we are recording them in a series of tellers, tales and traditions weekends that we do.
And you have your website that people can go to, shonalee.uk.
Indeed I do.
Some of those stories are on video, so if people want to check them out, they can go there and see.
Yeah. Nicely segued though. I like
thank
that.
Thank you so much.
But the other thing I was going to say, you know, don't ask a storyteller a question, they'll just go off on one, was my concern that if they get written down is they become a linear narrative. They become just a series of stories, much like the Greek myths, one after another after another, which although would preserve them, wouldn't hold them in what my husband refers to as the lattice, this interweaving of stories, this world within worlds, this way of shifting from one story to another and back again and moving between the stories, because they all inhabiting this world, would get lost if they were written down. And so that is the conundrum.
They lose their magic, or they lose their interconnection,
sense. That dexterity and that playfulness, maybe.
But you also have a concern that you're the last Drutsila, you're the last person of your tradition that you're aware of. Do you want to talk about that at all, how that feels? Or
what? Apart from feeling a bit like a dodo.
Which is so not the case.
Well, I don't know. You know, one hopes that maybe there are other Drutsilas out there. There are certainly many, many wonderful Jewish storytellers. Because as a people, we make sense of our world by telling stories. There's a lovely Jewish saying, why did God create people? Because he loves a good story.
Well, there you go.
So there are many wonderful Jewish storytellers. Whether there are any more Drutsila, because it was peculiar, it was mainly in the Netherlands and it was held orally, it was so common, it wasn't really documented. And with the events of the Second World War, by the First World War, you were getting much more movement in those communities and industrialization anyway, and women were beginning to learn to read and write. But by the Second World War, what you got was those communities being completely uprooted, and obviously with the events of the Holocaust, the primary holders of those stories and that tradition, the older women and the young girls, being put into the camps and not making it out. You know, an entire generation, pretty much, of Drutsilas disappearing. So a tradition that was so common, as common as the plastic bottle of water that we drink out of. So it wasn't worth documenting. It was something the women did with the children.
Yeah.
Very nice, yes. To pretty much extinction in the space of 5 years. It's an incredibly rapid rate.
Yeah.
By the time you've realised that it's becoming extinct, it's already
it's
too late.
It's already gone.
My grandmother survived. She was in the camps. She had sent my mother over to England by kinder transport, so she had this will to survive.
Can you talk about your mother's experiences a little bit? Because I think they're relevant to today's issues with refugees and so forth. Mm-hmm. You said that those who were on the kinder transport, they had to be under 16 and they had to have relatives in Britain. And if they didn't, they were sent back.
That is my belief. That is what I've been told. You know, I cannot say where it is written in black and white. But what I have been told is if you were over 16, you weren't eligible because you were an adult. So you couldn't go on kinder transport. Some 16-year-olds were allowed to go over because they were carrying babes in arms. But they then had to come back, which was pretty much a death sentence. And obviously, they didn't want a burden on the state.
Yeah.
So,
which is what we say now.
Exactly what we say now. And so it was useful if you had relatives over there, you were more eligible. My mother had relatives in England, but wasn't eligible because a lot of the kinder transports did not come out of Holland. They came from Germany and France, but they came out through the Hook of Holland. But my grandmother, you know, Bubba, her mother, realised very early. And I suppose pulled a few strings and my mother carried two babies.
Wow.
So she got her on to the last kinder transport, or one of the last, out of Holland. And then
now,
she herself came to live with us.
And now you, as the daughter of a refugee, you've worked with the European Court of Human Rights using your storytelling techniques to help people? Is that right?
Yes, it was mainly the lawyers that did the helping, not so much me, but I've worked with asylum seekers, I've worked with refugees, victims of abuse and the sex trade, and looking at ways of creating a story that everyone can work with. So the example, I can't obviously quote case histories because some of them are still going through the courts, but the way that we looked at it, I worked with a lovely lawyer, was when a lawyer puts a case forward, they are interested in the facts. That's what they need to win the case.
Right.
But sometimes those facts can be quite harsh.
Mm.
And so the person that is wronged, the victim, I don't like to use the word victim, but they feel that they are not being heard. But their story is very emotional.
Yes.
And you cannot take an emotional argument into court. There are ways of working around that. And so what I was doing was looking at the story in between, the story that both parties can work with.
So the story that the victim can tell honestly, but that is...
That the lawyer can then use.
The lawyer can take...
There's a term called violently agreeing and passively disagreeing. And so it was finding the way through, because we've all done it. We can say the same thing and mean something completely different.
Yes.
Or we can say different things and get quite heated. But actually, when you pull that apart, what you realise is we're saying the same thing, and it's recognising. And I think that's what story does. I mean, we've been looking at an exercise in the Midrash which gets you to look at something from a perspective where you would never normally be. And that allows us to empathise with something that is completely outside of our experience, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think if you're looking at the refugees, when you look at it as a whole, it's very easy to distance yourself. But when you have a father holding his child on a beach, you know, who cannot identify...
Everyone relates
to
that.
And it's humanising this thing.
For the sake of our audience, can you explain what the Midrash is?
It's quite hard, but Midrash just means to unpeel or to look at and to gain insight through unpeeling a narrative or a piece of work. And now there are rabbinical Midrashes that you find in the Talmud and the Tanakh, which are commentary on certain thoughts and ideas. But when a Dritzila talks about the Midrash, they're talking about a series of exercises that enable you to look at a story from different viewpoints, to ask the story and yourself and the characters in the story certain questions, and to gain insight, to really see maybe what's not there, but it is hidden in plain sight. So to read between the lines, which is very useful in dehydrating a story for your memory, but also very useful if you are taking the bare bones of a story from a book, which maybe doesn't appeal to you that much, but if you can midrash it, if you can see what's been not said and look at it and rehydrate it, then it makes it much more accessible and tellable,
excellent.
I think.
Cool. Now, I know you are looking for other Dritzilas. If someone were to know something that would be helpful to that search, should they contact you through your website?
That would be amazing. I would really, really like that. We had somebody suggest that there are communities in Lithuania.
Oh, wow.
That are still sort of intact, and maybe that would be a good place to start looking. So
that would be excellent.
I think that's a project that we'll be looking at. Any help? We've been looking since 2009. What we find is people in their 80s that remember hearing Dritzilas in their childhood. What we find is people, when I tell a story, saying, oh, my grandmother knew a story a bit like that.
Yeah.
So there are memories of the stories and memories of maybe them being listened to, but the whole tradition intact, it's very rare, and I think it would be wonderful. It's a bit like, you know, I suppose my Bubba survived with the tradition. She was living with us when I was born. And maybe through trauma, maybe through need, even though that community didn't exist, she just poured it all into me. So I usually say to people, I'm not particularly special or talented. I just happen to be in the right place at the right time and get the right bag of sweets.
Excellent.
And I've run with that.
Yes, absolutely. And you started telling at 18 in the house of a man named Peter Ustinov?
Not quite, no.
Not quite.
No. My Bubba was working with lots of people. I was telling from the age of 12. Didn't really want to be a teller. Wanted to go to drama school and be like an actor.
Well, yes.
Like you do. Got quite disillusioned with that because one day you'd be doing Shakespeare and the next week you'd be a dancing tomato in an advert. And by chance, my bubba was working with this guy, Peter Ustinov, who was a wonderful storyteller. And they were doing something and she had a heart attack.
Oh my goodness.
And couldn't do it and asked me to do it because I knew the stories. And that was kind of I thought, oh, this is much more fun.
Yeah.
And I can do this. And it was a slow burn from there, really, from doing it within the family and within circles of friends to actually going out and actually doing it to then making a living at it, which I never expected.
And yet here you are.
And yet here I am.
Excellent. Well, Shonali, thank you so much for speaking to us today and sharing everything that you have to share. Is there anything else you would like the audience to know before we go?
Too much. You can go onto the website and there's a diary on there. So if you want to find out where I am or what I'm doing, you can consult the diary, which is the most organised I've ever been.
Excellent.
There's a bit about me. There's a bit about the tradition, some of the stuff that we do.
A few of the stories.
Excellent. And I think that's it, yes.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for talking.